Welcome, Curious Minds, to another deep dive. Today, we're not just exploring a book, we're attempting to navigate, well, a philosophical Everest, Immanuel Kant's monumental critique of pure reason.
Yeah, it's definitely a big one.
It really is. And this isn't just challenging. It's a work that fundamentally redefines how we understand our own minds and the very nature of reality itself. What if everything you've ever taken as reality isn't just out there, but is profoundly shaped by the very architecture of your own mind? Okay, let's unpack this. Because Kant offers a radical, almost, well, mind-bending proof that our brains aren't just passive receptors, but active architects of the world we inhabit.
Absolutely. It's an intellectual journey that still reverberates, you know, through science, psychology, and how we approach knowledge today.
Mm-hmm.
And what's truly fascinating here is that Kant isn't just asking, what do we know?
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, philosophers have been doing for centuries.
Right.
But he's asking a much deeper, more foundational question. How is knowing itself even possible?
How is it possible?
Wow.
Yeah. He's embarking on this critical investigation into the nature, scope, and crucially, the limits of pure reason. It's an attempt to lay down a secure foundation for objective knowledge, especially scientific knowledge.
Okay.
And to show us precisely where reason can and importantly cannot take us.
So who was this thinker who dared to question the very bedrock of knowledge? Let's briefly introduce Immanuel Kant. Born in 1724, lived until 1804.
A long life for the time.
Indeed. He was a German Enlightenment philosopher from Königsberg, a small university town where he spent his entire famously methodical life.
Yeah, the stories about his routine are legendary.
Right. People setting their watches by his walks. But beneath that meticulous exterior was a mind of, well, unparalleled ambition. His intellectual reach was absolutely global, even if he barely left his hometown.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, Kant found himself at this really pivotal crossroads in philosophical thought.
Okay.
He was uniquely positioned sort of at the intersection of two warring traditions. On one side, you had rationalism, thinkers like Leibniz.
Right. Reason first.
Exactly. They believe true knowledge came from pure reason, independent of experience. You know, like mathematical truths, 2 + 2 = 4, you don't need to see it happen to know it's true.
Makes sense.
Then on the other side, you had empiricism, figures like John Locke and, crucially, David Hume. They insisted all knowledge derived from sensory experience.
See it, touch it, taste it.
Pretty much. Their motto was basically, nothing is in the intellect that wasn't first in the senses. And it was David Hume, the Scottish empiricist, who delivered what Kant himself called the jolt that awakened him from his dogmatic slumber.
Ah, oh, that famous phrase.
Yeah. Hume, with his profound skepticism about causality, argued that ideas like cause and effect were just habits of mind. We form them from repeated observations. But they aren't necessary truths built into reality itself.
So like the sun rising, we expect it, but there's no logical guarantee.
Exactly. Hume argued there's no logical necessity it must. And this posed a devastating challenge to the very idea of certain knowledge, especially for science, which relies heavily on cause and effect.
Wow, okay. So that really pulls the rug out.
It does.
And so Critique of Pure Reason became Kant's monumental attempt to resolve this foundational crisis. He saw that both sides, rationalism and empiricism, had valid points, but neither offered the complete picture.
Right, he wasn't just picking a side.
No, not at all. He spent over a decade in intensive thought, working mostly in solitude to produce this work. He believed it would offer a revolutionary third way forward, synthesizing these two seemingly incompatible views.
A grand synthesis.
Precisely. He sought to create a philosophy that embraced the rigor of rationalism while acknowledging the essential role of experience that the empiricist championed. Which brings us to what Kant himself called his Copernican revolution in philosophy. And here's where it gets really interesting. Think about how Copernicus radically shifted our view of the cosmos, right? Moving the Earth from the Saturn.
From orbiting the Sun, yeah. Big shift.
Huge. Kant proposes a similarly radical shift, but for our minds. We used to think our knowledge had to passively conform to objects out there, like our minds were just blank slates or mirrors reflecting reality. But Kant flips the script.
He really does. He argues that instead of our knowledge conforming to objects, objects, or at least how we experience them, must conform to our knowledge.
Whoa. Okay, say that again. Objects conform to our knowledge.
Yeah, that's the central thesis. The human mind isn't a passive receiver of information. Instead, it actively structures and organizes experience through its own built-in categories and forms of understanding.
So not a blank slate?
No, not at all. It's more like a sophisticated projector, actively giving shape and coherence to the raw sensory input we receive. We aren't just taking in data. Our minds are processing it, structuring it, making it knowable in the first place.
That's a profound shift. It naturally leads him to a very specific, maybe a bit technical question that underpins his whole philosophy. How are synthetic a priori judgments possible?
Right, that famous question. It sounds complicated, but it's key.
Let's break it down. A priori means knowledge independent of experience, right? Like logic, math.
Correct. Stuff you know without needing to check the world.
And synthetic means it adds new information. It tells us something genuinely informative about the world. It's not just a definition, like all bachelors are unmarried.
Exactly. Synthetic judgments expand our knowledge. Analytic ones just clarify concepts.
So the question is, how can we have knowledge that is both universally true, certain a priori, and genuinely informative about the world? Synthetic, like the basic laws of physics, maybe. How is that possible if it doesn't just come directly from experience?
And Kant's answer, in essence, is that such knowledge is possible precisely because the mind itself contributes the organizing principles that make experience coherent and meaningful in the first place.
Ah, so the mind provides the structure.
Yes. These principles aren't learned from experience. They're the very conditions for having any experience at all. Think of it like the rules of grammar. They're necessary for forming coherent sentences, even if we don't consciously think about them every time we speak.
Okay, that analogy helps. The mind has its own sort of grammar for experience.
You could put it that way, yeah.
Okay, so with that mind-bending premise established, our minds actively shaping reality, let's take that guided tour through Kant's methodical analysis of how the mind actually does this structuring. He breaks down our cognitive faculties into three main parts, right?
That's right. First, sensibility, then understanding, and finally, reason.
Let's start with sensibility.
Okay. Our tour begins with sensibility, which Kant explores in what he calls the transcendental aesthetic. Here, he makes a really radical claim about space and time.
Okay, I'm ready.
He argues they are not properties of objects out there in the world, nor are they concepts we somehow derive from experience. Instead, they are what he calls pure forms of human intuition.
Pure forms of intuition, like built-in lenses.
Exactly like built-in lenses. They are the necessary framework through which we perceive anything at all. Think of them as the fundamental operating system. Or maybe the pre-installed software of our perception. You can't not perceive things in space or experience events unfolding in time because that's just how our system is set up.
Wow. So space and time aren't containers out there.
They're containers in here, conditions of our own sensibility. Can you even imagine an object without it existing in space? Or an event without it unfolding in time?
No, I guess not.
Kant says these are built-in features of our perception, part of our cognitive hardware. And this, he argues, is precisely why geometry, which studies space, and arithmetic, which deals with succession, like counting and time, can provide us with that special kind of knowledge, synthetic a priori.
Because they describe the structure of our own experience.
Exactly. They describe the necessary structure of our experience, guaranteeing universal truth for anything we can perceive.
That's truly profound. The idea that space and time are part of us, not the world itself, it makes you wonder, like, would an alien intelligence experience reality differently?
It certainly opens that door, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So we've covered sensibility, the raw input, and its basic forms, space and time. Now, our tour takes us deeper into the mind's processing center, the understanding.
Okay, so this is where we make sense of it all.
Precisely. This is where Kant unveils how our brains actively organize those raw sense impressions, giving them form and meaning. Here, in the Transcendental Analytic, the understanding employs what Kant calls the categories of the understanding.
Categories, like mental filing cabinets.
That's a good way to think about it.
Yeah.
These are innate rules or pure concepts. Mm-hmm. Things like causality, you know, the idea that every event has a cause.
Right.
Or unity, recognizing multiple sensations as one coherent object, like seeing apple, not just red, round, shiny. Or substance, perceiving something as enduring even as its properties change.
Okay. And these are innate. We're born with them.
According to Kant, yes. They aren't learned from experience, but are the conditions for having coherent experience in the first place. They're the rules the mind uses to organize sensory input. And this is where Kant directly tackles Hume's skepticism about causality.
Ah, right. Hume said causality is just habit.
Exactly. But Kant says, no, causality isn't something we merely observe and infer. It's a fundamental category our mind imposes on our sensations to structure our experience of events happening one after another.
So our mind creates the cause and effect structure we perceive.
It applies that structure, yes. It makes objective scientific knowledge possible within the realm of our experience because that structure is universal and necessary for us.
Wow. That completely redefines what we mean by a law of nature if the mind is imposing those laws in a way.
It certainly complicates the picture. It feels like our minds are playing a much more active role than we ever suspected.
Which brings us to one of Kant's most famous lines, right? The one that sums this up.
Yes. Thoughts without content are empty. Intuitions without concepts are blind.
Okay, break that down for us.
Sure. Intuitions are the raw sensory data, the content, what we receive through sensibility, through space and time. That's the stuff coming in.
Got it. The raw feed.
Right. Concepts are the organizing principles, the thoughts, those categories of understanding like causality, substance, unity.
The filing system.
Exactly. So without the raw data of intuition, our concepts are just empty logical shells. They don't refer to anything real. Thoughts without content are empty.
Makes sense.
But without the concepts to organize them, the raw sensory data is just chaos, a bleeming, buzzing confusion, as William James later put it. Intuitions without concepts are blind. They lack structure and meaning.
So you need both. You need the data and the mental structure.
Precisely. Genuine knowledge, true understanding, requires both working together, hand in glove. The mind actively applies its concepts to the intuitions provided by sensibility.
Okay, so if our minds are actively structuring everything we experience, what does that imply for what we can truly know about the world as it exists, you know, independently of us? Before our minds get involved?
That's the million-dollar question. And it leads directly to another crucial Kantian distinction. Phenomena versus noumena.
Phenomena and noumena. Right. What are these?
This distinction is a direct consequence of everything we've just discussed. We can have real, robust, objective scientific knowledge about the world as it appears to us, structured by our minds. This is what Kant calls the phenomenal world.
The world of our experience.
Exactly. The world of science, where cause and effect apply, where objects exist in space and time. This is the world we live in and interact with.
Okay, but there's a but, isn't there?
There's a big but, and this is the crucial limit Kant identifies. We can never truly grasp things in themselves, as they might exist independently of our minds, without the filters of our sensibility, space and time, and understanding the categories. This reality, independent of our cognition, is the noumenal world.
The thing in itself.
The thing in itself. And it remains fundamentally unknowable by our theoretical reason. Not because it's necessarily mysterious or weird, but simply because we cannot step outside our own cognitive constitution to perceive it directly, unfiltered.
So we're kind of stuck inside our own heads, in a way. We can know the world as it appears to us very well, even scientifically, but not the raw reality behind the appearance.
That's a good way to put it. It's a powerful and perhaps humbling realization. It establishes a limit to human theoretical knowledge, not as a failure, but as an inherent feature of our cognitive setup.
Okay. Now, while sensibility and understanding work within the bounds of possible experience, the phenomenal world, Kant, then introduces a third faculty, reason. And here's where things get tricky.
Right? Very tricky. Because reason, according to Kant, has this innate, irresistible urge to go further, to seek ultimate unifying answers, to ask questions about things that lie beyond any possible experience.
Like the big questions.
Exactly. In the part called the Transcendental Dialectic, Kant explores what happens when reason tries to apply its concepts, concepts like causality, which are only valid for organizing experience, to these transcendent ideas. Things like the soul, is it immortal? The world as a whole, did it have a beginning? Is it infinite? And God, does it exist?
What happens when reason tries to tackle those?
It gets tangled up. Kant shows that when reason tries to make definitive claims about these things, which are outside the phenomenal realm, it inevitably falls into logical contradictions. He calls these the antinomies.
Antinomies, like paradoxes.
Pretty much. I mean, trying to prove whether the universe had a beginning in time or has existed forever. Kant argues that pure reason can construct equally compelling logical arguments for both sides.
Seriously, both sides seem logically sound.
From the standpoint of pure reason operating outside experience, yes. Same for questions like whether everything is determined by causal laws or if we have genuine free will. Reason generates these logical stalemates, these antinomies.
So this raises a big question. When we debate endlessly about these ultimate questions, the universe's origin, free will, God, are we just bumping up against these inherent limits of our reason that Kant identified?
Kant would say yes, absolutely. He argues these debates are often unwinnable by pure theoretical reason,
right.
precisely because they try to extend our concepts, which work for experience, into a realm beyond any possible empirical evidence, beyond where our cognitive tools are designed to function.
It's like trying to use a hammer to measure temperature. Wrong tool for the job.
That's a good analogy. And this realization, this philosophical speed limit sign, leads to another really powerful quote from Kant that clarifies his broader purpose. I had therefore to remove knowledge in order to make room for faith.
Remove knowledge to make room for faith? What does he mean by that?
It sounds dramatic, but it gets to the heart of it. Kant isn't dismissing these transcendent ideas, God, freedom, immortality, as meaningless nonsense.
Oh.
Far from it.
Yeah.
Rather, he's demonstrating that they cannot be objects of theoretical knowledge. In the same way science gives us knowledge of the phenomenal world, they are simply beyond the reach of our pure reason to prove or disprove.
So science can't touch them.
Right. But by demonstrating these limits of theoretical reason, he paradoxically clears a space. He makes room for faith and moral conviction. He argues these ideas, God, freedom, immortality, have a crucial regulative function.
Regulative function, meaning?
Meaning they guide our scientific inquiry, like striving for ultimate unity. They inform our practical actions. And crucially, they are essential postulates for our moral lives. We might need to assume freedom to make sense of morality, for instance, even if we can't prove it scientifically.
Ah, I see. So he limits reason's claims to knowledge, but gives these ideas a different practical importance.
Exactly. It prevents science from overstepping its bounds into metaphysics or religion, and it prevents dogmatic metaphysics from claiming the certainty of science. It gives metaphysics a new practical purpose focused on morality and hope.
Okay, let's try to zoom out then and pull together the core takeaways from this incredible deep dive. The central theme, maybe above all else, has to be the active, constructive role of the human mind in all knowledge and experience.
Absolutely. That's the Copernican revolution right there.
Yeah. So the mind isn't just a passive observer. It's an active participant, almost. Almost a co-creator of the reality we inhabit.
That shift in perspective is truly revolutionary, even today. And it reinforces that crucial distinction between phenomena and noumena. It emphasizes that while this sets limits on what we can ultimately know.
The thing in itself.
Right. But within those limits, within the phenomenal world, it actually secures the objectivity and certainty of science. We can trust our scientific understanding of the world as it appears to us because our minds are built to structure it in a consistent, law-governed way for all human beings.
That's a key point. He's limiting reason to save reason, in a way.
Precisely. And it also beautifully synthesizes those two warring traditions we talked about, rationalism and empiricism.
Right. He brings them together.
Yeah. Kant shows us that both sensory experience, intuitions, and innate mental structures, concepts, are absolutely essential for knowledge. Neither can stand alone. They need each other. Thoughts without content are empty. Intuitions without concepts are blind.
It all comes back to that.
It really does. And finally, I think this work inspires a profound sense of intellectual humility. It's a powerful warning against philosophical dogmatism, against thinking we have all the answers based on pure reason alone.
Because reason has limits.
Exactly. It reminds us of the limits of our theoretical reason. But paradoxically, by doing so, it makes room for faith and moral conviction. It suggests that while there are things we can't know in a scientific sense, there might be things we must believe or postulate for the sake of living a meaningful moral life. It really shifts the ground from what is absolutely true to what we can reliably know is true for us.
Okay, so this is fascinating, heavy philosophy, centuries old. But why should you, listening right now, care? How does this deep dive into Kant maybe reshape how we approach our daily lives today?
Well, that's the crucial question, isn't it? I think, first off, profoundly fosters critical thinking and intellectual humility.
How so?
Kant's work really encourages us to constantly question the frameworks and assumptions we bring to our observations every single day. It prompts us to ask, okay, how much of this perspective is reflecting the thing itself? And how much is being shaped by my own cognitive lens, my own categories, my own space-time framework?
Recognizing our own filters.
Exactly. And that naturally leads to greater open-mindedness, maybe more empathy when dealing with different viewpoints, whether it's in a personal disagreement or a larger societal debate. You start to realize your reality is filtered, just like everyone else's, though perhaps through similar human filters.
That's such an important point. It makes you realize that even when we think we're just seeing the facts, our minds are already deeply involved interpreting and structuring those facts using Kant's categories.
Right. And this deep dive also has implications for the scientific method and even thinking about artificial intelligence.
Oh, interesting. How?
Well, understanding how our minds structure reality helps us refine how we conduct scientific inquiry, recognizing the role of hypotheses and theoretical frameworks. And for AI, it raises fundamental questions. If our minds bring these pre-existing categories like causality to experience, what does it truly mean to build an AI that can understand the world in a human-like way?
Right. Does AI need its own innate categories, or can it learn everything?
Big questions. What are its inherent limitations if it doesn't possess something analogous to our innate structures? Kant gives us a framework for thinking about that.
And you mentioned navigating debates.
Yes, finally, I think it offers a powerful tool for navigating those seemingly unwinnable debates. Recognizing when arguments, whether they're political, ethical, religious, maybe even just about art, start to transcend the realm of possible empirical evidence.
When they enter the realm of the noumenal or try to misuse reason.
Exactly. Recognizing that can help us step back from fruitless, entrenched conflicts. We learn to identify when we, or others, might be trying to apply categories of understanding, like cause and effect, to a realm where they simply don't belong according to Kant, or where pure reason hits its inherent boundary, the antinomies.
So it teaches a kind of philosophical patience, knowing when an argument might be structurally unresolvable by reason alone.
I think so. A knowing when to perhaps pause or shift the grounds of the discussion towards practical implications rather than absolute theoretical proof.
I love that analogy you used earlier. It's like realizing we're all wearing these incredible, complex virtual reality headsets that we can't take off.
Yeah.
And Kant has just given us the user manual. It doesn't let us take the headset off, but it explains how it works.
That's a great way to put it.
It changes how you engage with everything, really, helping you see the filters in your own perception and understand the limits of what you can definitively claim to know. So this deep dive into Kant, into the critique of pure reason, reveals something truly profound. The world isn't just out there waiting passively to be discovered. It's also, in a very real and fundamental sense, in here, actively shaped by the incredible architecture of our own minds.
It's a monumental work that really did transform philosophy by showing the active, constructive role our minds play in literally every piece of knowledge and every single experience we have. It's a call to both intellectual rigor, understanding how we know, and profound humility, understanding the limits of what we can know. And maybe that leaves you with a provocative question to ponder. How does this knowledge, the idea that your mind is an active architect of your reality, change how you approach learning or problem solving or even just observing the world around you tomorrow? Will you start looking for the lenses, the categories through which you see the world?
Keep those questions alive. We encourage you to continue your own deep dives and reflections on these truly foundational ideas. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.